Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Once more, summertime crinkles into autumn leaves like old songs crackling through winterly anxieties. Today, September 5th, is the original Labor Day, which was originally premiered on today's date in New York City in the year 1882, 142 years ago. Although Labor Day has been retailored into a three-day weekend for America's laboring masses, as have most USA holidays, and also signals the end of the summer silly season, it also, quite appropriately, if inadequately, gives a semblance of credit for the so-called common folk who are the true mind and muscle of human civilization. And perhaps it might also be appropriate to heed former poet laureate of the USA, Howard Nemiroff, who was a veteran of World War II, which started 85 years ago on September 1st, 1939, when Nazi Germany invaded Poland. "The reason we do not learn from history," Nemiroff said, "is because we are not the people who learned last time." So now, something I wrote for my newspaper, my defunct newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, in commemoration of Labor Day: Labor's Labor Lost. Labor Day means little more than a final three-day holiday that ends the silly season. Once it celebrated working people, but now that is a joke. Unions don't march on Labor Day anymore, and the few who put on a show are merely window dressing. Andrew Levson wrote in The Working Class Majority that cliches about the USA as a classless society are, quote, "exposed as hollow by the simple fact that American workers must accept serious injury and even death as part of their daily reality," unquote. Every year, at least 100,000 workers are killed or die of work-related accidents or disease. 40,000 or so are disabled, and about 6 million are hurt at work. Imagine the universal outcry that would occur if every year several corporate headquarters routinely collapsed, crushing 60 or 70 executives, Levison wrote. Or suppose that all the banks were filled with noxious dust that constantly produced cancer in the managers, clerks, and tellers. Finally, try to imagine the horror if thousands of university professors were deafened every year or lost fingers, hands, sometimes eyes, while on their jobs. The power of American labor unions as a force to represent and protect the rights and persons as well as jobs in American industry has faded over the past decades. Union strike power is vulnerable to diversified mega corporations, especially in highly automated industries, and virtually powerless to halt overseas relocations. Union busting has decimated some of the country's largest and formerly strongest unions. Labor law has failed to protect workers, and government acts as a tool for the company. Corporations breach labor laws and are not held accountable. Union strikers are arrested and heavily fined. The bitter assault by government and industry has crippled union power to such an extent that unions are unable to gain significant wage raises or protect the jobs of hundreds of thousands who are sacrifices to company mismanagement, downsizing, or divestiture as a result of incessant corporate Wall Street-inspired takeovers and mergers. The American labor movement succumbed to its own success and the long-savored revenge of the bosses it temporarily trumped. The power labor gained was immense, was bitterly won, and carelessly lost. When the Reagan administration chose to attack in the early 1980s by breaking a strike by aircraft controllers and forever banning the strikers from government work, it was aware the labor movement was weak and unable to resist a savage campaign of union busting. Unions were by then little more than huge bureaucracies that had lost contact with their rank and file. Their leaders were raised to social levels with salaries plus perks equal to executives of equal rank. Dissent was usually squelched within the locals, while union and corporate officials colluded on the same class level. For members of most unions, mandatory dues were, and remain, a tax on their wages, at the same time they were denied meaningful or coherent representation. The corporate class bitterly resented the labor movement's power and exacted savage revenge, attacking unions in their shops like wolves circling downed beasts. The older industrial unions were ripped apart. Thousands of workers were forced to take huge pay cuts and the loss of medical and insurance benefits to keep their jobs in industries that were crippled, dismantled, or sold off. Many thousands more were laid off when plants closed or relocated to the Third World. Communities that depended on smokestack or sold off industries paid huge ransoms of public money to keep them operating or to attract newer ones. Top echelons of corporations dismantled their subsidiaries to protect their headquarters bastions from corporate raiders, in the meantime, feeding on each other in a frenzy of takeovers. Their unions gutted and powerless to protect them. American workers have been pawns and generally losers in the bloody corporate wars. Disinherited at the same time, American corporations have employed offshore foreign labor to make their products at cheaper cost. The new realities of world commerce aggravates the problems affecting American labor. American corporations subsidize cheaper labor and manufacturing costs in third world countries by ordering finished products from them instead of producing domestically, which adds not only to imbalance of trade, but shrinks the number of jobs for American workers. Real work shifts overseas, where the only competition is in degrading wages and increasing production, especially among young women, reminiscent of U.S. sweatshops in the early part of the 20th century and more recently in the Pacific Southwest. As the American working force shrinks, the power of the already weakened unions is further eroded. Workers in need of work accept low-paying and non-union jobs and lose their rights and protection. Trotsky was right when he said that labor must be universal rather than national, because corporate industry is global. Jobs are cut in the USA and exported offshore to third world countries with non-existent or harassed labor movements. Violations of international workers' rights are used for competitive advantage by U.S. corporations that search the world for impoverished countries with low-wage workers, even employing slave and prison labor while engaging in destroying labor movements and imprisoning or murdering labor leaders. Unions once were, in the words of Kurt Vonnegut, admirable instruments for extorting something like justice from employers. But labor is badly wounded, and its history is treated like pornography. Strikes are crippled with injunctions, and workers are denied government aid while on strike. Union busting has frightened union leaders into painful compromises, and binding agreements are torn up by management. The legal framework of the labor movement needs radical change. Political solutions in which workers' rights and union democracy in its broadest sense are guaranteed are necessary. A generous concept of labor democracy would give workers more rights, both in collective bargaining and law, and would allow them a voice in investment policy and in such matters as layoffs, plant shutdowns, takeovers, and in selection of top management. The tax code should be revised to credit companies that avoid layoffs in profitable times and give employees a stake in company policy, as well as good medical coverage and broad retraining opportunities. Workers' rights should be manifested in various ways that would prohibit employer interference in their decisions about organizational representations, which should include unions with only a minority of workers and mandate collective bargaining that leads to solid contracts. Radical changes in labor law must obviously be accompanied with wide involvement of women, blacks, Asians, and Hispanic Americans, plus physically handicapped and mentally retarded workers, and should focus on a social crusade framed as an extension of American democracy instead of pressure group whining. A special effort should be made to recreate a social justice movement like civil rights in the 1960s. Such a sharply defined crusade would be an initial stage in educating and mobilizing union members. The next objective would be for these members to spread labor's gospel as far as possible in schools, churches, civic meetings, political caucuses, to bring strong political support into the labor movement. More workers need to be organized and be willing to risk and endure long-standing picket lines, like automobile mechanics who lost both their strike and their jobs several years ago in Astoria, Oregon. Rebirth of a robust labor movement requires enfranchising women and minorities. The rise of vigorous new leaders untainted by corruption, reversing the decline and increased costs of education, and most importantly, collective action and collective bargaining to halt labor's collapse in post-industrial America. Reestablishment of a union culture in the United States and radical reforms of union laws must be a primary goal for the good reason that labor and production are at the heart of economic and political health and survival. As the man said, unions are bad, but without them, it's worse. That perception is all too apparent when thousands of workers lose their jobs, the discrepancy in wages and benefits between management and labor is obscene, and the people who have jobs are required to produce more for less pay with little or no job security. The first permanent national labor organization in the United States, the International Topographical Union, acknowledged at its first convention in 1850, "It is useless for us to disguise from ourselves the fact that under the present arrangement of things, there exists a perpetual antagonism between labor and capital, one side striving to sell their labor for as much, and the other striving to buy it for as little as they can." And that was something I wrote, Labor's Labor Lost. And now, from the Washington Post, Trump allies test a new strategy for blocking election results, by Amy Gardner, Patrick Marley, and Colby Itkowitz. When a member of Georgia's Fulton County Board of Registration and Elections refused to join her colleagues as they certified two primaries this year, she claimed she had been denied her right to examine a long list of election records for signs of fraud or other issues. Now the board member, Julie Adams, an avowed believer in the false theory that the 2020 election was stolen from former President Donald Trump, is suing the board, hoping a judge will affirm that right and potentially empower others in similar positions elsewhere to hold up the outcome of elections. To voting rights activists, election law specialists, and Democrats, such actions represent an ominous sign that could presage a chaotic aftermath to the 2024 election. They are particularly worried about the threat of civil unrest or violence, especially if certification proceeds amid protests or efforts to block it. Adams wrote in her lawsuit that she swore an oath to prevent fraud, deceit, and abuse in Fulton County elections, duties that she says are not possible without examining the records she has demanded. Her detractors say she is seeking the power to block a victory for Democrats. The Democratic National Committee and the State Democratic Party have asked to intervene in the suit, claiming Adams' actions are part of a coordinated effort by Trump, his allies, and the GOP to sow the same kind of doubt in this year's presidential election that led to the violent attempt on January 6, 2021, to overturn Biden's victory. They are playing poker with the cards up, says an executive director of the Democratic Party of Georgia. They are telling us exactly what they are going to do. We would be foolish if we sat on our hands and did nothing and watched this happen. Trump has stated plainly that the only way he can lose this fall is if Democrats cheat. His campaign and the Republican National Committee are spending historic sums building election integrity, and that's a quote, operations in key battleground states, preparing to challenge results in court and recruiting large armies of grassroots supporters to monitor voting locations and counting facilities and to serve as poll workers. Certification of local results is a key target in this effort, a once mundane administrative step that has become a flashpoint in the debate over election security and a potential opportunity to subvert the will of voters. Election officials in the nation's 3,000-plus counties must sign off on results, followed by a similar process at the state level. Typically, certification does not mean there were no errors. It simply reflects the votes tallied at that point, and it does not preclude lawsuits contesting those results. In fact, in some states, lawsuits cannot be filed until after certification is complete. Barring such challenges, certification allows the winning candidate's electors to then gather in each state capital to cast their electoral college votes, with a joint session of Congress taking the final step of affirming that vote on January 6th. Delaying certification at any step could hold up or halt the process, potentially preventing the rightful winner from taking office. Since 2020, county-level election officials in five key battleground states, Georgia, Arizona, Michigan, Nevada, and Pennsylvania, have tried to block the certification of vote tallies in both primaries and general elections. So far, none of the efforts have succeeded. In some cases, the actions came up against strict state rules limiting the role of county election boards in determining electoral outcomes. And critics say those rules will serve as essential guardrails this fall to thwart any coordinated efforts to set aside a state's popular vote. But the chaos and confusion that could result from such an effort are themselves a deep concern among voting rights advocates, who believe that unsubstantiated claims of fraud by Trump and his allies are sowing even deeper mistrust in the fall election results than they did 4 years ago, raising the potential for unrest and even violence on a greater scale also. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program. The 2024 presidential race has unexpectedly turned into the most exciting in this new millennial century and lays bare a fundamental contradiction of American democracy. Kamala Harris represents the USA's three most prominent racial groups besides being a woman. Also, she is eons smarter than her incredibly shabby and crooked opponent, who has been found guilty in one trial, which was as much about his rampant sexism as it was about his claim of financial superiority, with more than a dozen felony charges yet looming. He probably hopes a White House will prevent his dwelling in a jailhouse.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.